Warm welcome to all who have gathered here today. Good afternoon, good evening, depending on your location. There's quite many of us, so it's absolutely wonderful. I would like to welcome you all on behalf of today's hosts, which are the EU-based Nuclear Transparency Watch and the Sustainability Learning Lab at St. Thomas University, New Brunswick, Canada. My name is Dr. Madis Wasser. I am a senior expert on SMRs in the environmental organization Estonian Green Movement, which is the Estonian chapter of Friends of the Earth. And I'm also a member of Nuclear Transparency Watch. And we were discussing a few months ago different topics on SMRs, like what should we focus on, what should be the most practical and useful thing to know. And we quickly focused on Canada because this is at least where most of the current European SMR projects are very keenly looking at. As this flagship country where different projects have been on their way and as something to follow. So, indeed, Canada has had a strategic SMR plan in place already since 2018, and many projects have been proposed. And our aim today is quite simple, is to assess how good or how bad these projects are going currently and to base it on facts. And to see perhaps what other players can also learn from it. Luckily, such an assessment has just been compiled, and with us today are two of the authors to present it to us. So we have Susan O'Donnell, who's an adjunct research professor at the Sustainability and Environmental Studies Program and primary investigator of the CEDAR project at St. Thomas University in Fredrickston. And also M.V. Ramana, who is a professor and Simons Chair in Disarmament, Global and Human Security, Director Pro Tem School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And also we have other helpers in the chat. There's Brennane and Malcolm, who might answer some of your questions in the chat. And also please use the Q&A box that you will find somewhere in the Zoom. And I will do my very best to try to manage these questions and make sure that the most burning ones will be asked to the presenters as well. And yes, recording will be available, slides will be available afterwards. And the plan is to have about 30 minutes, maybe a bit more, of the presentation of the report card, so to say. Then perhaps a small short roundtable between me and the authors, and then plenty of time for Q&A. So don't hold back, ask what you want to know. And then we will make so that these things get answered. So, without further ado, if I'm correct, then Susan should take the stage.
Great. Okay. Hello, everyone. I'd like to start by thanking Malcolm de Butler from Nuclear Transparency Watch for inviting us to do this webinar and bringing Canada's story to a global audience. And thank you, Mattis, for moderating this event, and Brennane Lloyd, Northwatch and Nuclear Waste Watch, for being the chat master today. So today, my colleague M.V. Ramana and I will bring you our assessment of the progress of small modular nuclear reactors, SMRs, in Canada. We're working together on the research project CEDAR that is publishing the report today this webinar is based on, and most of what I will be saying today comes from that report. Canadians, as Mattis just mentioned, were introduced to SMRs in 2018. When the nuclear establishment in Canada published a report, a call to action, a Canadian roadmap for small modular reactors, and we call that report the roadmap. It's a strategy for developing SMRs across Canada, and the roadmap report stated that the first demonstration SMR could be deployed by 2026, with the first commercial deployment by 2030. So it's 2026, the first milestone. It's time for an assessment, and that's why we wrote our report. An SMR is designed to generate 300 megawatts of electricity or less, and that's compared with all operating nuclear power reactors in Canada, which are the CANDU design that generate 500 megawatts or more. The term small has no implication for the physical size of the reactor. For example, the Darlington SMR design, the BWRX 300, includes a reactor structure 73 meters tall, that's 240 feet or 21 stories, with 35 meters above ground and 35 meters below ground. The term modular is aspirational. It refers to how these reactors are envisioned to be assembled on the site of the power plant using various components or modules that are manufactured at a different factory site. And some SMR designs are also described as advanced, and these refer to reactor designs that are not cooled or moderated with water, light or heavy water. So SMRs are very different from the existing CANDU design in Canada. Over the years, the CANDU models progressively got bigger to take advantage of economies of scale. The 2018 strategy to focus on smaller reactors is thus a major departure from this path. Building SMRs amounts to abandoning economies of scale, aspiring instead for potential cost reductions by manufacturing in factories. But these cost reductions will only happen if there are many orders from SMRs. But that is unlikely because, as Ramana will briefly discuss, electricity from SMRs will be very expensive. Our report reviews the 10 SMR designs that have or had a presence in Canada. We use two main indicators of progress: the financing achieved by the SMR design in Canada and the status of the SMR design development in Canada. And we do specify in Canada because all but one of the SMR designs are owned by companies that have offices and activities in other countries, primarily the US. In the initial SMR roadmap and the subsequent five official reports, the stated primary goal of SMR development is to decarbonize power grids to meet Canada's climate action targets. Another state of motivation for SMRs in Canada is economic development and jobs. And so far, governments in Canada, that's Canadian taxpayers, have spent more than $4.5 billion on SMR activities. So, what did we get for that money? I will turn that over to Ramana to talk about. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. And thank you all for attending and for organizing this event. As Susan said, we are picking off from the SMR roadmap and we are trying to do an assessment. And the first thing I want to say is that quite early on, the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission decided that it was going to try and enable SMRs to be set up in Canada. And so very early on, they started this looking at SMR designs through a process that's called the Pre-Licensing Vendor Design Review. And what that is a process by which a nuclear reactor vendor would come to CNSC and talk about, I mean, give them details about their design. And CNSC's sets a staff would try to evaluate whether it is possible to license this. So is there a roadblock or something like that? And as we will talk about it later, you know, many of their conclusions typically say there is no roadblock towards actually building an SM licensing one of your designs. And then these vendors then can use it in multiple ways, for example, to raise funding. I start with this precisely because the sort of rush to moving SMRs to Canada and this for vendors to engage in the vendor design review process started somewhere in about 12, 13 years ago and seems to have you can date it to when the United States had a process in the Department of Energy to give funding for two SMR designs. Those things ultimately went to two light water reactor designs, mPower and NuScale. Following which, a lot of other SMR designers who are initially looking at the US market seem to have decided to move to Canada. And that's and the CNSC itself would say our licensing process is very different, and that's when a lot of them came up to Canada. This is one of the things that we have sort of looked at. The main nuclear reactors designs that were talked about in the roadmap itself were three different streams. One stream was the first stream is the BWRX 300 is the example of that. These are grid connected small modular reactors, typically close to 300 megawatts in capacity. And then they were in the second stream, there were two different designs which were considered to be advanced nuclear reactors. Like Susan said, these are nuclear reactor designs where the coolant is not water. And so there were two of these designs that were considered to be part of this stream. Those were the ARC-100, which is a sodium-cooled fast reactor design. And the other is the Moltex reactor, the stable salt reactor, as they call it, which is a molten salt reactor, which also involves the extraction of plutonium from spent fuel through a process that the Moltex company calls WATS, waste to stable salt. And the fuel, therefore, for Moltex would involve also plutonium. And so these are the two designs that were considered to be part of these advanced reactor stream two. And then lastly, there was the micro modular reactor, which is an example of stream three, which are reactors that are relatively small in their capacity. So initially, the micro modular reactor used to be a 5 megawatt reactor, and then they upscaled it to 15 megawatts. And these are intended primarily as off-grid reactors that would be in remote communities or mines and so on and so forth. All of these are very different from the CANDU reactor, which is the staple of the Canadian nuclear establishment. Canada has been building these CANDU reactors since the beginning of the nuclear age. They have exported it to multiple countries like India and South Korea. And they sort of, it's a heavy water cooled, heavy water moderated nuclear reactor, which uses natural uranium as fuel, which is uranium that's not been enriched. In contrast, the BWRX 300 and the micro modular reactor and ARC-100 would all require enriched uranium. And the Moltex stable salt reactor would involve the use of plutonium in its fuel, which has not been done in Canada so far. Just a very brief sort of updates on all of these different designs. The CNSC, the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, has issued a construction license for the BWRX 300 to be built in Darlington in Ontario. But it was even at the hearing that considered this design, it was clear that the design was still incomplete. There were still parts of the design about which there were questions, and the proponents did talk about having to update the design in order to meet some of the requirements for safety that the CNSC had said. So the construction license has been granted, but in order for the license to actually operate the reactor, it will require the full design details, and we will see how that comes about. So far, there has been a little over $3 billion in funding from the federal government and $1 billion in funding from the Ontario government. And this is all public funding. They have tried very hard to get private funding, but so far there have been no private investors. The Globe and Mail, Canada's leading newspaper, carried an article which talked about where a high-level OPG or Ontario Power Generation official said, exactly that they have not managed to get any kind of private funding. And what you see here is that this funding that has been provided so far is inadequate for even constructing one of those reactors. The plan is to build four of them, but the first one has been costed at $6.1 billion. And then an additional $1.6 billion has been estimated as the cost for all of the site preparation, including for 0.5 possibly hosting four of these BWRX-300 reactors at that point. But so far, OPGE has only applied to construct one of those, and the expectation that they will follow it up with three more. And if all of them are built, the current cost estimate is $20.9 billion. This is very likely to be an underestimate given the history of cost escalations when construction actually starts. The second reactor design that I'll talk about is the ARC-100. As I mentioned earlier, this is a fast neutron reactor, which means it has no moderator, but it uses molten sodium as coolant, and it's a scale-up of a small experimental reactor that operated for many years at the Argonne National Laboratory in the United States, and it uses enriched uranium fuel. Canada does not have any enrichment facilities, so this fuel will have to come from somewhere else, most likely the United States. The other feature about the ARC-100 that is problematic is that most sodium-cooled fast reactors around the world have used something called MOX fuel, which is a mixture of plutonium and uranium oxide or other forms of enriched uranium oxides. In contrast, ARC is trying to use the fuel without any kind of oxygen in it, which means that it will swell when it is irradiated. Once the nuclear reactor starts operating, the fuel will be subject to a lot of damage by radiation, and it will swell up, and that can pose problems. The third reactor design, which I mentioned, is the Moltex stable salt reactor, which is kind of, again, unusual in that there have been molten salt reactor designs that have been considered around the world, and one operated for 4 years at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in the United States. In all of those, the molten salt was in a large container where the fuel was sort of undergoing fission. In contrast, what Moltex is trying to do is to put the salt not in a large reactor vessel, but inside small fuel tubes. So it's kind of trying to combine the kind of fuel that is used in CANDUs or light water reactors with the molten salt. And there is no experience whatsoever with such a reactor. So this is a very experimental design about which there are a lot of questions. The fuel that it uses, as I mentioned, involves some mixture of plutonium and uranium. Different presentations from Moltex have slightly different percentages, so don't treat this as the final number. But this is just an illustration of how much plutonium, how much fraction of the fuel is constituted by plutonium and various other salts. The challenge with salts is that they typically tend to be very corrosive, so this is one of the problems that was encountered in Oak Ridge. And the other feature of this particular reactor is that to produce the plutonium, Canada would have to do reprocessing, which a variation of the standard reprocessing process, which is called pyroprocessing, where there's an electric current that is sent through to try and separate out the plutonium and others. There are only theoretical and laboratory studies. There's no commercial facility that does this, and there are many problems that have been identified with scaling up this for commercial use. Moltex has been having a lot of trouble again raising funding, and sorry, both ARC and Moltex have raised funding from the New Brunswick government, but at some point, New Brunswick says these reactors are not going to come online quickly enough, and therefore it doesn't look like these things are going to move forward. The last reactor design I'll talk about is the micromodular reactor. This was expected to be Canada's first SMR. In March 2019, they submitted an application to CNSC for license to construct. The micro modular reactor is also a new reactor design that is new to Canada. It's a high temperature gas cooled reactor, which is cooled by helium gas. There have been only four such reactors built around the world that were in commercial operation, two in Germany and two in the United States. And all of them had operational difficulties, which is one reason why nobody has pursued this very much. But still, this was expected to be Canada's first SMR. And when the company that is sort of put together the proposal called Global First Power, which is a kind of it involves three different companies, and it's a kind of shell game, which I'm not going to be trying to describe because I'm sure I will get it wrong. But the leading company there, called Ultrasafe Nuclear Corporation, in October 2024, basically filed for bankruptcy protection under Chapter 11 in the United States. And at that point, there were over $16 million in unpaid balances, including $641,307 to the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission that they had not paid so far. I will actually, I should stop here and let Susan sort of talk about the other reactor designs.
Thank you, Ramana. Okay, so Ramana just discussed four designs. I'm going to speak about the other six because our report looks at 10 SMR designs in Canada. The criteria for selecting these designs, for either they were referenced in the strategy, they received funding from or signed an MOU with a government in Canada, or they formally engaged with Canada's nuclear regulator, the CNSC. So the four designs that Ramana just spoke about were referenced in Canada's SMR strategy. All of them had proponents in Canada, and all were planned for an existing nuclear site. These four collectively received more than $4 billion in public funding, and as Ramana mentioned, most of that was for the BWRX 300 in Darlington. So that's four. Of the final six SMR designs, not one has a proponent. Three of them collectively received more than $55 million in public funding. That's Westinghouse Electric for its EVNC design, Terrestrial Energy for its IMSR 400 design, and the Canadian Space Mining Corporation for its LEU-NR design. In addition to the direct funding that I just mentioned, that I'll tell you about in a minute, to the SMR design vendors, there's other organizations, a lot of them, that receive public funds to support the development of these designs. Okay, so of the last six, the EVNC has received the most money. Westinghouse Electric received more than $27 million in public funds for its EVNC design. The current status: the EVNC design is currently being studied in Saskatchewan. However, the Westinghouse Electric Company's website states that all EVNC staff are working under one roof at a single site in the United States. Next down the line, in terms of the amount of public funding received, is the IMSR 400. That's the Integrated Molten Salt Reactor. And that company, Terrestrial Energy, received more than $25 million for its design. And after, so the current status is that after 2023, the Terrestrial Energy website has no more news releases featuring the design in Canada. And all of the significant updates in Terrestrial Energy's 2026 shareholder letter pertain to the US. And then the third reactor to receive significant funding is the LEU-NR. That's the low enriched uranium nuclear reactor. It's a micro modular reactor design. And it received more than $3 million in public funds to a company called Canadian Space Mining Corporation that since has changed its name. So that particular reactor design is the only one in our study of the 10 that's owned by a company that does not have an office outside of Canada. The company CEO of that design said he wants to commercialize the technology, quote, for people living and working on the moon. We could find no reports of design developments. So that's three of the six. Of the final three designs, two received no funding. That's Holtec International for its SMR160 design, and then Westinghouse again for its AP300 design. And then there's a company, X Energy, that received over 400,000 for a study of its XE100 design. So the final six SMR designs, five of them have offices in the US and other countries. And we are interested in why so many SMR companies with activities outside of Canada have or had an office in Canada and what they hope to achieve here. So in Canada, only four Canadian provinces have expressed an interest in or funded SMR activities. That's Ontario, New Brunswick, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. And Ramana already discussed the SMR plans for Ontario and New Brunswick. In Saskatchewan, the federal government has given Saskatchewan more than 130 million for SMR activities, and the province has spent about 85 million on SMR activities. The power utility, SaskPower, has selected the BWRX 300 design for potential deployment in Saskatchewan, but it has not placed an order. And the government in Saskatchewan has said it will decide in the year 2029 whether or not to build an SMR. But they also released a strategy that calls on the federal government to pay three quarters of the cost of the first reactor in Saskatchewan. In Alberta, the federal government has given more than 15 million for SMR activities to organizations in the province, and the Alberta government has spent just over 1 million on two studies of SMRs. One of the studies is about the use of SMRs in the oil sands, and it was a study conducted by the oil company Cenovus. So Cenovus ended the study early when they found out, and I'm going to quote from their report, and this again is from the Alberta oil company Cenovus. From a business perspective, SMRs are not economic or commercially feasible at present or in the near future. The capital costs are high, the timelines are long and uncertain, and technology and supply chains lack maturity. There is potential application for industrial heat needs, but significant progress in these areas is required, which may not happen for several years. So I'm just going to end that there and turn it back to Ramana to talk about the cost of SMRs.
Thank you, Susan. Picking up on something that Susan mentioned in the beginning, when you go from large reactors to small reactors, then you lose out on economies of scale. This is something which is a well-known principle in a lot of industries, that the cost of a particular facility does not scale linearly with the size of the production capacity of the facility. So sometimes engineers use some kind of rough formula in the kind that I've shown. For those of you who like formulas, that's a number to sort of remember, a 0.6 scale. But all that basically means is that when you build a reactor that is, let's say, generating three times as much electricity, the cost of building the reactor is not three times as much as as a reactor that generates smaller amount of electricity. And that's simply because you do not need three times as much concrete or three times as many workers in a larger facility. That's what economies of scale is really capturing. And this has been well known sort of theoretically in a lot of industries. And in the case of SMRs, if you look at all of the estimates for recently constructed or planned SMRs around the world, you see that their per unit costs are going to be much higher. I should have sort of clarified that when I'm talking about higher costs, it's in the in terms of cost per unit of electricity production capacity, so cost per kilowatt or megawatt. And if you look at the cost estimates of recently, SMRs that are either under construction or proposed for construction, you find that the cost per kilowatt are all quite high. I'd like you to sort of focus in particular on the middle row for NuScale, which for some years used to be the SMR design that was expected to be constructed first in the United States. It was the first one to receive regulatory clearance from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the US, and they had a definite project in Idaho with a set of clients who are the Utah Association of Municipal Power suppliers. And that project, the cost of it kept going up and up, and then the final cost estimate came out to be $9.3 billion US for 462 megawatts. And if you try to calculate what that translates to in terms of how much it costs per kilowatt, it turns out to be about 250% more than the cost estimate per kilowatt of the Vogtle nuclear reactors, the large nuclear reactors that were built in the United States, in the state of Georgia. Those things ended up costing, they were initially expected to cost about $14 billion before construction started, and the construction cost exploded to $37 billion. And there's no doubt that if NuScale actually had gone ahead with construction, its cost estimate would have also exploded. So what I'm comparing here are the initial cost estimates before construction starts, and you see that the NuScale's cost per kilowatt is much higher than that of a large reactor. And large reactors themselves are not economically competitive. Therefore, there's no way small modular reactors are going to be competitive on in a market. And one institution that has been tracking this quite in the for the last several years has been Australia's main research organization called the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, CSIRO. And they've been producing reports every year, partly because Australia is having a debate over whether to build nuclear plants. And for various reasons, Canada and the province of Ontario have figured very prominently in the Australian debate. Ontario has been held out as a model place that Australia should emulate by the people who are proposing to build nuclear plants in Australia. And so CSIRO, for that reason and for other reasons, has been tracking particularly the cost of small modular reactors. And in their last report, they used actually the cost estimate of the Darlington power plant as their basis for their estimate for capital costs for small modular reactors. And what you see in this graph here is are their estimates of what it might cost to generate 1 megawatt hour of electricity from different sources of energy. And you see that SMRs are the highest. It's that big band out there, ranging from a little bit over 300, these are Australian dollars per megawatt hour, to over 600 Australian dollars per megawatt hour. In comparison, you see that solar and wind are under 100. So it's somewhere between 3 and 6 times the cost of wind, and even more in the case of photovoltaics. What's also interesting about the CSIRO study is that they take into account one of the standard arguments made by people who are lobbying or advocating for nuclear power to say we should not be compared with renewables because renewables do not produce a steady source of electricity. Their output varies with the speed at which the wind is blowing or how much the sun is shining. And so they say this is, you cannot be comparing this. And so what CSIRO has done is to look at how much it would it cost to ensure that the electricity grid can be reliably run with fairly high fractions of what they call variable renewables, wind and solar and possibly offshore wind. And they show that, even with as high as 90% of share, the cost is very, very modest and far lower than having to add a small modular reactor. The last thing I will mention about sort of economics is that there was one of the use cases that was proposed in the SMR roadmap and other documents that came out at that time was the stream of reactors that were meant for remote off-grid communities and mines and so on. One of our students and a colleague of mine, we did a study in back in 2020 where we looked at two elements of this argument. The first element of that argument is, are there really enough sites Is there enough demand from all of these mines and remote communities for a large number of small modular reactors? Because as Susan mentioned, the economic argument for small modular reactors is we're going to move away from economies of scale to what kind of savings we can get through mass manufacture in factories. So if you're going to have to mass manufacture these, you have to set up a factory. The factory costs a certain amount of money. And if you have to justify that investment in the factory, if you're going to build, let's say, only, if you're going to build thousands of cars, it makes sense to build a factory. But if you're going to only build one car, it really doesn't make a sense to build a factory. It's the same argument here. And what my colleagues and I did was to look at what is the demand, how many remote mines are there, and we looked at all the, summed up all of that, and we showed that the amount of demand is inadequate to even justify building one factory. And the second element was we tried to calculate what would be the cost of producing electricity. And the argument why SMRs were being proposed in this place was precisely because these communities had to rely on diesel that was shipped from far away. So their energy costs were already very high. So the expectation was in these markets where electricity costs are very high, energy costs are very high, SMRs might actually make sense. And we showed that that also is not true. The cost of producing electricity from SMRs is something like, $3 plus, whereas the cost from diesel is about 30 cents, so roughly a factor of 10. This depends, of course, on the exact set of assumptions, but that basically shows that these are going to be uneconomical even in this remote circumstance. And I'll end my thing from that. I mean, Susan is going to talk a little bit more about the Canadian Nuclear Laboratories, which has been a central element in trying to promote SMRs. And I leave you with that quote from the president, which says, back in 2018, where he says, "The place is Canada, the time is now, your partner is CNL." Thank you.
Thank you, Ramana. So this is my last part, and I saw some notes in the chat. I do not have slides. I'm just talking. So there are many reasons why Canada is pushing SMRs, and in our report we discuss several of them, but I am just going to talk about one of them here that's central, which is the Canadian Nuclear Laboratories that runs the Chalk River Laboratories, which is Canada's premier center for nuclear research and development, R&D, and it has been for more than 60 years. And the institutions there want to keep it that way for SMR R&D. So a little more than 10 years ago, the nuclear establishment in Canada considered the Chalk River Labs to be out of date and run down. And Canadian Nuclear Laboratories convinced the federal government to modernize Chalk River. And the Chalk River Modernization Plan was built around SMRs. The plan was to demonstrate the commercial viability of the small modular reactor by 2026. And that was the MMR design that Ramana talked about. And the plan was to position Canada, and this is a quote, to take a leadership role in this emerging nuclear technology, with Canadian Nuclear Laboratories recognized globally as a leader in SMR prototype testing and S&T support. So the nuclear establishment made many promises about SMRs to the Canadian government and parliament. And in 2016, the federal government committed $800 million over 5 years to modernize the Chalk River site. 2 years later, the cost of the modernization had arisen to $1.2 billion, and the cost has risen since then, but the actual costs are not available for public scrutiny for a reason I'll mention in a moment. The centerpiece of the Chalk River modernization plans is a new research center to conduct research on SMRs and so-called advanced nuclear materials, which is mostly the different fuels for the proposed SMR designs in Canada. The cost of the research center, which is planned to open in 2028, has tripled from its original estimate and is now projected to cost more than $1 billion. Canadian Nuclear Laboratories is also very active within the federal government and the university nuclear research community to push SMR research and development. And the reason that the SMR costs at Chalk River are not open to public scrutiny is that 12 years ago, Canadian Nuclear Laboratories was privatized. And since that time, Chalk River has been managed and run by private companies. So it's not subject to the Access to Information Act, and we don't know the details of its cost. When Chalk River was privatized, the contract was awarded to three companies. Two of the three companies that were running Chalk River were American companies with ties to the nuclear weapons industry. And last year, the contract to run Chalk River was awarded to a different consortium. The contract is for $24 billion over 20 years. And so Chalk River is now run entirely by American companies. And interestingly, all these companies have ties to the nuclear weapons industry. Currently, a parliamentary committee is studying the management of Chalk River by American companies. The briefs filed with the committee raised questions about the nuclear fuel research going on at Chalk River and the potential links with the American nuclear weapons industry. But these are open questions that our research cannot answer. We can just ask them because the information is not public. So that's it. Now it's your turn. We've left a lot of time for questions. We're looking forward to your questions, and you're welcome to ask questions about anything we've said, about anything that's going to be on the in the report that you'll receive a link to very soon, or anything else about SMRs in Canada. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Ramana. It's been a lively Q&A happening here, so I will try to summarize what have been some of the themes then, and maybe add a few more sentences from my side as well. It's good that we already kind of touched on the historic aspects as well, because SMRs are not a new thing, although it's like a new wave of hype, one would say. Already Ramana mentioned mPOWER, which is what's now a couple of decades ago. Let's try to do the exactly the same narrative that we hear today. You mentioned NuScale, which is a newer kind of mishap, let's say, from a recent few years. Somebody in the Q&A mentioned Japan's Monju NPP, which had a sodium leak some decades ago. And also on the slides, there was the Karam design, which I would argue now the cost estimate is basically infinite because it was cancelled after all these years and all this money. So you have to divide by zero to get the cost estimate, so it won't end well. But one of the questions in the Q&A was about technology, and specifically on the uranium question. So it reads like this: I have heard that the Canadian government may have interest in establishing processing of enriched uranium in Canada rather than importing from the US. Are you aware of this being the case?
I could maybe start that to answer that question, and then I'll turn it over to Ramana. I have, and our CEDAR project has done quite a number of access to information requests. There's no question that in the last couple of years, there's a lot more talk behind the scenes about enriched uranium and possibly building an enrichment plant in Canada. Whether that will come to fruition is kind of interesting because, in order to make that worthwhile, you actually have to have a number of reactors that would want to be using this enriched fuel. And it's not at all clear that we're actually going to have that in Canada. But Ramana knows a lot more about uranium enrichment than I do. So I'll turn. Yes, you do. You're
I
shaking your
do, but I think I don't want to add to this. We have a lot of questions, so I don't think
head.
I'm
Okay.
going to add anything significant to this. So,
Okay, I'll
in the
end it
interest
there.
of time, yeah, let's.
Right, then I go through the first list I have, and then I will go back to see maybe in some of the topics we will have more questions. But next on my kind of small list is the financial side. So you mentioned that for the BVRX 300, that's like the flagship project, private funding is really hard to find at the moment. So why do you think that is so? Is it because it's simply the first of a kind and it will be very, very expensive to build that? Or do you have some other theories?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's frankly, I don't really know why they've not been getting. I mean, the obvious answer is, it's going to be uneconomical, it's going to be expensive, there may be cost overruns, there'll be delays, and private parties will not want to come into that. But at the same time, I also have to say that if you look at investment patterns around the world, there are a lot of places, especially in the country south of where we are, where there's a lot of private money flowing into nuclear power, even though it makes absolutely no sense, sort of from an economic point of view. And so all that one can sort of assume is that the people who are investing in these nuclear plants either have too much money or they are trying to do this as a way to first invest in it and then make the stock price go up and then eventually sell it off. So it's a kind of Ponzi scheme of some kind. That is not so common here in Canada compared to the United States. So that could be one reason. But real answer is I don't know. I cannot, I mean, I can guess some, make some guesses, but I don't think I really know.
I think you've heard, you've said it in some other places as well, that even Bill Gates doesn't put their money in, at least not in a considerable amount. And also what we see in Europe, if I can comment as well, is that even if you start with private money, your goal is really to unlock the public funds.
Exactly,
So we see it
exactly, exactly.
in Estonia, especially when for the few first years, it was all about private capital, and then now it's transitioned into this. Well, we can't do anything without the public funds.
But in Canada, you didn't need the initial seeding from private funds. The government was already giving out money, so there's no need for them to put in their money.
Another question related to the cost aspects that was asked is that, when you look at the cost of electricity, does it include the cost of radioactive waste disposal usually?
In principle, the answer is yes. There is usually some kind of, I mean, it depends on how you do the cost estimates, not for the construction cost, but the cost of producing electricity. There's usually some kind of payment that is allocated towards waste. So the way it actually works out in many in countries is that utilities are expected to set aside a certain amount of money for each kilowatt hour of electricity, and that money is accumulating over the lifetime of the nuclear reactor as it's operating, then eventually that is going to be their contribution to dealing with the waste. It's not we don't because there are no operating repositories anywhere in the world. We really don't know how much it is going to cost, right? So these are estimates, and usually what you'll find, and the UK is the best example here, that the cost estimates for actually dealing with this turn out to be much higher than what was initially envisioned. So that is one issue. The second thing to remember is that all of these cost of electricity generation, they provide what is called a levelized cost of electricity, and that is they use a particular technique called discounted cash flows, and in those kind of calculations, any kind of expense that is happening far into the future, decades into the future, contributes very little because of the whole discounting procedure. And so even if you assume a larger cost estimate for the disposal of nuclear waste, it's not going to change the cost of electricity very much. So it's not a very significant factor in the cost. The primary driver of the high cost of electricity from nuclear reactors is the cost of constructing the nuclear reactors.
And related to that, perhaps is a question on many people's minds is, how do we compete against this wasteful spending of our hard-earned money and the taxpayers' money? So do you have any good tips on that?
Well, it's very interesting because you would think, because of the cost differentials now, especially with the alternative potential sources of electricity generation, power generators, the disparity is so huge. For example, with renewables and storage, you would think that would just kill it right there. But for example, in New Brunswick, we just had a budget presented yesterday. That is, they're really under the gun in terms of, spending for health and education, but they managed to find almost $10 million to help prepare the site at the Point Lepreau nuclear site for a new reactor. Even though we know it's going to be very expensive electricity, and it has proven to be very expensive in New Brunswick. So there's something else in mind. something else behind it. And I think, it's really interesting. And one of the things I'm really interested in, and that's why I spoke about the piece with Chalk River and the link with American companies and why are all these American companies here, the link with the nuclear weapons industry. I think it's a much more complex reason why it's so hard to make the argument that financially it doesn't make much sense, because it really doesn't make any sense financially, but it doesn't seem to matter. I don't know, Ramana, what do you think about that one?
This is a how do we fight back is of course a very big question. I don't think I have any particular insight that needs to be shared. I mean, we all have to figure this out strategies together. All I would say is that in some cases, some of the old arguments don't seem to be working anymore because of the kind of rhetoric that we see about the need for energy and AI and data centers and so on, that all of these arguments, which have traditionally been important parts of the debate, seem to have been set aside. So this is something we really have to figure out together. And actually, I'm quite open to hearing what other people think about this.
Maybe I'll just mention, because I saw Angela Bischoff, it just came up that she wrote this, and this is something that we do mention in our report, and both Ramana and myself and colleagues have written about this, is now what we've seen industry-wise is the fossil fuel industry teaming up with the nuclear industry and the promises to build nuclear reactors as a way of continuing or expanding the use of fossil fuels to to generate electricity. And we see this certainly in the four provinces that have signed on to SMRs, which, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario, and New Brunswick all are, into the promise of more nuclear, but at the same time expanding their use of fossil fuels for electricity generation. So there is sort of an alignment there about promising to build more nuclear as a way of continuing fossil fuel use.
We already touched a bit about the waste management issues, so maybe just a general background on are there or what are if there are problems of combining the nuclear waste of SMRs along with the CANDU dry waste in the proposed deep geological repository. So do you know anything about that?
I'll just say that I would say the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, which is the industry's organization, has been very, very fuzzy about what is supposed to happen with the waste from SMRs. And at times they say, well, it's going to be put into the other repositories with the CANDU waste, and then they say, no, we need another one. It's just very fuzzy. But Ramana, I don't know if you can say anything about,
Yeah, I think the my own sense is that they pretend we can put it into the repository in some fashion. There's no need for a new repository. However, if some of these so-called advanced designs are constructed, especially the ARC-100 and Moltex and so on, the kind of waste forms that they will generate are not going to be disposable or they cannot be buried in the same kind of repository because they will require very different preparations in advance because of the chemical nature of those wastes. So I don't know if actually NWMO or anybody has grappled with this question adequately. And Brennan might also know things about this.
And I will add from the European side, because Nuclear Transparency Watch is also part of the URED2 science project that looks at, in other things, they also look at the waste streams of small and advanced reactors. And what I see from the eyes of the regulators in different countries is like real dread of like this type of waste will be quite different. And it doesn't seem to confirm to the previous notion of what a nuclear waste package would look like or behave like. So a lot of research, just basic research, is really needed before we can actually answer this question. And Brunein, if you want to jump in from the Canadian side, feel free.
Yeah, I'll just say, as Susan said, NWMO is playing a shell game on where the SMR waste will go. 2016, when the action plan came out, they were proclaiming that, of course, they could take the waste in the single repository. Since 2023, when they recommended in their integrated strategy for radioactive waste, that there will be a deep geological repository for intermediate level and non-fuel waste, they have since then added in the fuel waste from new reactors. So that's the Peace River, Wesleyville, Bruce C, SMRs. The work NWMO has done to date on their proposed repository, which they've cited at the Revel site in Treaty 3, has all been based only on the CANDU model. So their used fuel packaging plant, their transportation packages, their estimates of sizing and spacing and everything is all based on the characteristics of the CANDU waste. The current conventional CANDU waste, not the Monarch. I think they have to start at square one with a different waste with different dimensions, different characteristics, different burn up, different heat, thermal print, all of that. So I think they don't have a plan. Thanks.
As one comment or question put it, there is a plan by the Moltex company saying that they claim that their technology will, in their words, use the nuclear fuel waste currently at the Point of the Pro nuclear generation site to make it go away and produce energy in the process. So, can this claim be explained? Is this a correct claim? And just remind us again, how is the Moltex project doing overall?
Susan can talk about how the Moltex project is doing overall. I'll just say a few words about this claim about using radioactive waste. Technically speaking, there is no way to actually use all radioactive waste, right? Radioactive waste is a catch-all term. It involves a lot of different radioactive substances that are produced inside the nuclear reactor, either through the process of fission or through the process of some of these materials absorbing neutrons and getting converted into other materials. Plutonium is one such material. When this pyroprocessing or reprocessing or any of these processes are done, what they are trying to do is to extract out plutonium and maybe some of the unfissioned uranium, leaving aside all of the other radioactive materials. Those materials, there is no way to actually use in a nuclear reactor to fuel it because those other radioactive materials do not fission. There is the idea that you can actually use waste is kind of wrong, technically speaking. All you're using is one very small component of the waste, which is plutonium.
Okay, maybe I'll just mention a few things. So last October, so 6 months ago or whatever, our energy minister said that the New Brunswick is no longer interested in waiting around for first of a kind reactors, specifically Moltex or ARC. So that's kind of how it's doing overall in New Brunswick. But I will just say that Moltex was one of the first companies to actually sign an agreement to do research on fuel with the Chalk River, with the Canadian Nuclear Laboratories. And they've since continued with several more agreements to do research on the fuel. And this is an example of and why we do mention Chalk River in the report. The whole rationale is around doing research on advanced nuclear fuels. Well, if there's no advanced nuclear fuels in Canada, it kind of raises into question what all those billions of dollars at Chalk River for the modernization are for if there's no fuel to research. So it is kind of interesting that the Moltex project has managed to kind of continue to do its research with Canadian Nuclear Laboratories, kind of as a rationale for making the what's happening at Chalk River to make sense. But economically and in terms of proponent, there is no proponent for Moltex. It has no private sector funding of any relevance, and the government has basically abandoned it. So that's the story.
So the next question will have a bit of a pre-story. It's about public perception. It goes like this. The Ontario government is running daily TV ads here in Ontario, advertising the wonderful projects that are supporting to improve growth and making Ontario better. They include the Darlington SMR project in these ads and note that Ontario is a leader in deploying these technologies within the G7 group. And I want to ask, what is the current state of the Darlington project? Is it being built? Because in other countries we hear that it's almost done already. So what it is in like actual terms, and at the same time also, how do some even very pro-nuclear people see this project in particular?
Susan, do you want to start?
No, go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I'll just say, construction has started in a sense, but technically speaking, in the way that the International Atomic Energy Agency and others that try to track nuclear projects, they use a particular metric, a particular marker, which is when concrete is first poured into the base mat of the hole that is built to host the reactor. And so that hasn't happened so far, right? They are right now drilling the hole that Susan mentioned, 38 meters in depth. So that's what is happening right there. I want to sort of jump back to the question of the advertisements, and I think that's it sort of ties back to some of the discussions we had about how to fight back about this. So the thing to note about public perception is that it changes all the time. I've studied a lot of how the public views nuclear power, and you'll see these surveys and opinion polls. They vary all the time. And typically, when there is some event like Fukushima that reminds people that this is a dangerous technology, then the support falls a lot. And then, but the nuclear industry is constantly sort of putting out propaganda saying we need nuclear power, it's clean, it produces jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And so eventually, these levels of support sort of keep rising. And we have to keep fighting back against this propaganda, and it's a very, very hard thing. The last thing I'll say is that, Susan also mentioned that jobs is often something that they sell very often in their advocacy for nuclear power. The jobs argument is interesting in that you are investing a huge amount of money, and no matter what you invest it in, there are going to be some jobs that are created. And the question is whether the product that is being produced through that investment is actually going to be usable. So one example I give is, if I had a lot of money and I decided that I want to spend, $50 million constructing a company, a factory that is going to manufacture video cassettes from the 1980s or something, right? And of course, the whole bunch of construction people and engineers and other people will be employed in this particular factory to make those video cassettes. And except for a few collectors, nobody's going to buy those things, right? So SMRs is a little bit like that. If you put in a lot of money, of course, there are going to be some jobs that are created. But if the power that it's producing is very high, it's very expensive, it's not likely that many people are going to buy these SMRs.
And for the next question, we need the slides of Mr. Romana. Like the last batch you had, slide 10. This is the most popular question. Can you define what K and S meant in that slide? We can't hear you. We
You're on
can't see the
mute.
slides.
Sorry. I don't think I need to share the slide. It'll just
Okay.
take me too minutes to sort of talk about that. But essentially, the two things are the cost of the project and the size of the project. So in the case of nuclear reactors, you can think of S as the output power level, design output power level, and K as the capital cost of constructing that nuclear reactor. So the equation basically says that the cost of the building a project scales as the 0.6th power, which means that it's sort of a little bit like a square root. Okay, and I don't know if that makes it any easier for people who are not used to equations. But the argument basically is that if I were to think about two reactors, one generating 1,000 megawatts and one generating 200 megawatts, the output of the 200 megawatt reactor is just 20% of the output. So the company that is owning that will be only able to sell 20% of the kilowatt hours that the larger company will be holding. But The cost of building the nuclear reactor for that, according to that equation, will be 40% of the cost of constructing a 1,000 megawatt reactor, right? That's what that equation is telling you. So the cost does not scale with the amount of output.
Another question or topical theme here in the Q&A is the military connection, or the question of, well, small reactors have been used by the military, at least in the US, for a long time. So what's the difference now with these on land reactors? Why it is so difficult for them to be pushed out?
They're very different. And actually, you do hear that from the nuclear industry themselves saying, oh, these things are, they've been around, everyone's using them, they're perfectly fine, etc. Maybe I'll turn it over to Ramana to explain what the difference is between the military reactors and civilian reactors and why we can't just take a reactor from a nuclear submarine and put it on land. And yeah.
The military reactors are primarily in submarines, as Susan mentioned, and they produce all the power that a nuclear submarine is going to be using, including electricity. So in principle, you could, connect a wire from that and try to transfer that. But that'd be very stupid because the nuclear reactors that are operating submarines are designed to do a lot of things that these on land nuclear power reactors are not expected to do. So, for example, the power output of a submarine reactor might have to vary very quickly when the submarine is accelerating or suddenly stopping and things of that sort. These are not the kinds of demands that you typically make of a nuclear power plant. The power plant's output is typically held fairly constant, maybe a little bit of moderation in places like France to account for the fact that nuclear is such a large fraction of the energy output there. Anyway, so what that means is that the kind of fuel that is used in submarine nuclear reactors is very different and much more expensive than the fuel that is used in nuclear power plants, right? So it would actually be an even more expensive way of generating power than a typical large nuclear reactor or small nuclear reactor, which itself, as I've mentioned, is very expensive. Yeah, I put in the chat an article I wrote recently that talks about the many connections between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. That sort of addresses a lot of the other elements here.
And also, when we talk about nuclear power, we also have to talk about the health impact. So, regarding SMRs, is there some different claims? I know there's recently been scientific articles about the proximity of nuclear power plants and relationship to cancer frequencies, but how do the SMR industry proponents kind of frame that?
Well, I'll just say, first of all, it's really not clear if we're going to have operating SMRs in Canada, right? So, I mean, I think those kinds of questions, and yeah, there's some interesting studies that have just come out kind of confirming what we have been shown in other studies, that there is some kind of a proximity relationship between, living within a certain number of kilometers of a nuclear power plant and having a higher incidence of cancer, different kinds of cancers in the population. But that supposes that we're actually going to have SMRs in Canada. I mean, I suppose a lot of people are banking on that the one at Darlington is actually going to work to generate electricity on the grid. Whether OPG is actually going to build the other three is an open question. It's still not clear. But presumably, those reactors would have the same types of potential health impacts that any nuclear reactor would have. But I'll turn it over to Ramana to.
So first of all, I'll say something which people who know a lot more about epidemiology have concerns about this recent paper. There are actually two papers that came out from Harvard Public Health School of Public Health, and I'm not the numbers that they cite are much too large for what you would expect. So that's just so just be careful about citing that. I'm not an expert on this, but people who know a lot more about this tell me that this is suspect, and I take them seriously. Okay. So just to say that, I'm not saying they are wrong, but I'm just saying that there are concerns about this. But in general, yes, nuclear reactors are going to be bad for health in possible two ways. One is whatever they emit during routine operations, and then the other is when the and by routine operations, I also am thinking about the very long-term risks associated with nuclear waste, because ultimately the plan is to just kind of bury it somewhere, and sooner or later that is going to contaminate the water table at some level or the other. So that's a very long-term risk. But the other risk, of course, with nuclear plants is that of accidents, like what happened in Chernobyl and Fukushima. Now, what the small modular reactor designers would tell you is that the probability of an accident at a small modular reactor is much smaller, right? Now, strictly speaking, if all else were equal, then a smaller nuclear reactor is safer, or the risk of getting a high level of radiation dose from an accident at a small reactor is going to be lower than for a large reactor. This is for a couple of different reasons. One is obviously the amount of radioactive materials inside one of these nuclear reactors, small reactors, is going to be smaller compared to a large reactor. And the amount of energy that is available to disperse that radioactive materials, like the sort of cloud of radioactive substances that went out of Fukushima or Chernobyl, the amount of energy that is required to do that is also going to be smaller in a smaller reactor. So all else being equal, a smaller reactor can be, in principle, safer in terms of the consequences. The problem is that all else is never equal, right? When they propose to build small modular reactors, you're planning to build multiple reactors at the same site. Like Darlington, they're thinking about four. The NuScale proposal used to initially involve 12 NuScale reactors, and then came down to six. But these are always multiples that are being proposed. And if you look at what happened in Fukushima, we saw that the meltdown at the first reactor immediately started affecting the chances of a meltdown at other reactors, because radiation levels were so high, maintenance staff could not access the second reactor, and so on and so forth. And so that kind of thing will happen with any kind of multiple projects, right? The second thing that many SMR vendors are trying to do, and this is not so true here in Canada, but it's definitely much more true in the United States, is that they say this reactors are so safe that we do not need a containment structure, right? They will change the nature of the design and reduce some of the safety features that have helped reduce the impacts of accidents or the likelihood of accidents, right? So the other thing they talk about in the United States a lot is to reduce the emergency planning zone, the area in which people will have to be planning for evacuation in the event of an accident. That is a small cost for these operators, because they have to do periodic drills and so on and so forth. They don't want to do that, so they want to shrink the emergency planning zone into the facility itself. And the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, has basically signed off on that kind of idea. And so it's actually reducing the safety by pointing to something else. So all that is to say that SMRs, on paper can be safer, but in practice they will not be safer.
Or again, as the European regulators are saying, that if these SMRs will be closer to city centers, they will have much higher requirements for safety than something on in the countryside somewhere. And perhaps the designers haven't thought about it yet. We're nearing perhaps the end of the time we have. I just wanted to maybe mention and ask your additions to this notion that if you're looking at the BVRX 300 in Darlington, it's a very special project in many sense. So when people, for example, in other countries are looking to also build the same design in the same time frame that is claimed, they need to remember that the Darlington site was not a greenfield site. It's next to an existing nuclear reactor. The planning didn't start in this very late process. It already is using an environmental assessment from 2010, I believe. So there's some special properties in this specific project. And am I also missing something else? Because like the claim that these SMR projects can be propped up in like 4 years or less is something that is very pervasive and might not be fully true.
Maybe I'll just say something else, and I don't know if Ramana has any data on this, but one of the things that intrigued me about the work going on right now at the site, at the Darlington site for the BWRX-300 reactor, is the more than 3 kilometers of tunnels for the water cooling system that had to be built with a bespoke tunnel bore that was actually made in Europe, because we didn't have one that could do the job in Canada. So these are tunnels that are 6 kilometers, sorry, 6 meters wide and 3 kilometers long next to one of the Great Lakes. That implies to me that there's a lot of water required to cool the reactor. And I know that in France, for example, over the last couple of years with the dry summers they've had, they've run into water problems just cooling the reactors that they have. And sometimes the reactors have had to be shut down because the water levels were not sufficient, and the water that would be discharged was going to be too hot for environmental reasons. So I do have questions about, how these how the BWRX-300 in particular can be just kind of plopped anywhere that's not next to an ocean or a Great Lake, for example. Raman, I don't know if you've seen anything on that.
I mean, I think these are concerns. I think in France it is much more of a concern than in Canada because of the where they get their water from. The Great Lakes are called the Great Lakes for a reason because they are much larger, and so the temperature is not such a usually such a problem there. But definitely that's going to be an issue. I want to sort of go to the other part of the question about what Matt has mentioned about how fast are these going to be constructed, right? And again, the claim from the industry is that because of their modular techniques of manufacture of construction, the reactors can be built very quickly, right? Because they say, okay, we're going to have all these factories that are pushing out these modules. We'll just bring them to the site and assemble it. But historically, this was precisely the promise or the argument that Westinghouse made about its AP1000 reactor. For many, many years, they were talking about how the AP1000 reactor would be built within 36 months, which is 3 years. And for a while on the Westinghouse website, they used to have a small animated video that sort of brings all these kind of Lego blocks together, and it'll show 1 month, 2 month, 3 month. And then at the end of 36 months, you'll have a replica of a nuclear reactor, right? The real world doesn't operate like that. You can do computer animations, but in the real world, it took about three times as much of time to build in the AP1000 reactors. I think we'll see the same kind of thing with SMRs as well, that in actual fact, it is not going to be quick. And also, it is going to be stymied by this chicken and egg problem, which is unless you know that there's a sufficient demand for SMRs, no vendor would want to build a factory exclusively to build all the components for a particular SMR. So what many of these companies, including BWRX-300, are doing is that they make contracts with multiple companies, right? And each company is going to be supplying a different part, some from Hyundai, from all these places. That is a recipe for delays, for challenges. We have seen this process play out in Olkiluoto and other places where, because there are different suppliers, they never always sort of talk to each other properly. There's some translation challenges. And ultimately, when you try to install a particular component, it will not fit or something will happen, right? That makes them send it back there and bring it back a new component. That is the kind of challenge you should be expecting to see if these reactors start getting constructed, if people are following this carefully.
So I would ask the final question, and you can take a longer answer then. So we finish before half past. So the question is about listening to your story and your talk today. We see that still national governments, companies still continue to claim very wild information. That really contradicts to what the report and what your experience is saying. So how can people listening today, how can they help to correct this false information that's rampant? What's your ideas? What's your suggestions, your next steps? We read your report, we spread it around, and then what?
Yeah, that's so I will say this is what I can do. We can sort of try to churn out some prose in various places, in various forms, in the forms of reports, in the forms of books, in the forms of op-eds. But other than that, as somebody who is teaching in a university, I can talk to my students a little bit, but that's about all we can do, right? There are other people who are out in the world who can intervene in other fashions. And so it should not be for me, who is sitting inside an ivory tower university, to be prescribing course of action. But Susan is sort of much more linked in with social movements. She may have more intelligence to share in this than.
Well, it's very interesting who the politicians, because a lot of these decisions are political, right? The funding comes from public bodies, governments, and it has to be politicians who sign off on this. Who are they listening to? And 5 years ago, it was 5 years ago this month, Ramana, that you and I and three of our colleagues, including Gordon Edwards, who's in the chat, all with PhDs, who provided a briefing for the then Minister of Energy in New Brunswick about the problems with the ARC and the Moltex designs. And we met twice with him to talk about this, and we had a briefing document. And it didn't seem to matter because subsequently he went on a webinar and talked about how he learned everything he knew from the C about nuclear from the CEO of Moltex. And he was just charmed by the fellow, and that's what he talked about. And so this is part of the problem. The heads of these, nuclear startups and nuclear companies, they're very, very, very skilled, and they bring all of these promises and, all these glitters of, riches and gold and jobs and all the rest of it. And it's extremely, extremely persuasive. To politicians, especially, who just want to believe in the vision. And that's what we keep getting, these ads in Ontario, for example. Fortunately, we don't have them in New Brunswick yet, but just about, how this is going to create this wonderful world where we never have to worry about energy again and all this, and without even kind of dealing with the root problem that we're talking about here. And maybe we could get into that in another webinar. Which is that, we're promising a kind of utopia that is absolutely impossible living on a finite planet, right? And this is what nobody really wants to get into because it's not a very good story.
Yeah, and I will add that certainly you don't have to have a PhD to be in these discussions. You certainly don't have to be a PhD in physics to be in these discussions because, as we say jokingly here, the nuclear physics part has been worked out. That's the easy part. It's all the other aspects that are need to be taken care of. So it's the financial side, the technical side, the public participation and perception, and so on, and. As we say in the Nuclear Transparency Watch as well, we're not pro-nuclear or anti-nuclear, we're pro-safety. So in the end of the day, this is what it should all come down to. Like, if these things will be built, will they be built safely? Will they be operated safely? Will the waste be managed safely? And if, like, the answer to some of these questions are, well, we'll figure it out later, then that's not a good answer. So that's what we'll see with the Canadian example now. How they will do it, will they do it? If they succeed in the Darlington project, for example, then other projects may also succeed. If they fail, other projects will certainly also be cancelled. So it's interesting, like this whole wave of this renaissance of the SMRs is really tied up in this. Canadian example. So it's as we spoke some years ago, like you didn't re realize yet that everybody's watching Canada, but it is so. And I'm very grateful for the report that you've done. Can't wait to read it as well, and I guess for others as well, read through it, look where the citations go, and read through those as well. And wherever you're based, there will be an SMR project near you popping up if it hasn't popped up yet. So the I guess a good example or the good advice is to just dig into it, look what's it all about, see how much of it is real, factual, scientifically based, how much of it is just kind of beautiful 3D pictures of non-existing designs. And then I think the debate will be more high quality overall as well. So that's all from my part. If Susan or Romana wants to say some final words, now is your final minute.
I'll just mention that Brenane, who handled the webinar registration, is going to send me a list of everyone who registered just right after this session. And within an hour, I will send you the link and publish the publish button on the report. So you'll be getting that soon. Thank you.
And thank you all for attending and this very rich discussion, and at least a shared sense of how we need to fight these projects. Thank you.
But have a good rest of the day or the evening, wherever you are. Take care.